This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, January 31st, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. The technology of surveilling the U.S. border has never been better, but it's not clear what security benefits it provides, while the costs to liberty of some of that technology is particularly troubling. Cato's David Beer and Matthew Feeney discussed the new tech of border surveillance. Where did this discussion begin with securing the border? How far does that idea go back in at least recent political history?
Well, you're really talking about the origins of illegal immigration in the United States. And so you really have to talk about the changes that were made in the 1960s that eliminated really the largest guest worker program in the history of the United States, the Bracero guest worker program, that was allowing Mexican farm laborers to enter the United States legally every year. About 500,000 or so at its height were entering the United States with legal work permits. When that was eliminated, a circular flow of illegal immigration replaced it, where people would come across the border from Mexico for a few months, work in Arizona, California, and Texas, and then they would go home at the end of the season. And this was hugely beneficial to agriculture in those regions. And so Congress started debating really in the 70s, but then it really heated up in the 1980s when you had more than 1 million Mexicans crossing the border illegally every year. And during the 1980s, you had a debate about how do you address, first of all, the people who've been here for a long time. How do you address agriculture's needs, and how do you secure the border? And really in the 1980s, you started seeing more of this idea of an invasion. People are invading our country and they are taking our jobs, and that sort of rhetoric really amped up. And in 1986, Congress addressed that issue by passing a law that provided amnesty or legalization to 3 million Mexicans. Half of them were seasonal farm laborers. The other half were long-term residents of the United States. And it attempted to provide more work visas for agriculture as well. But at the same time, it called for huge increases in border security, including some fencing and a major increase in Border Patrol agents.
How much of that, I mean, a wall or a fence is a piece of technology. How much at the time was there a reliance on specific pieces of technology versus just more people driving around?
Well, it was far more tilted toward more people. So you had only about 3,000 or so Border Patrol agents back in 1986, and then today you have about 20,000, and so you're really talking about a massive increase in terms of manpower. And really, in the 1990s, you had an initial fence being built very cheaply between San Diego and Tijuana, Mexico. And that was only about 14 miles of the border that was fenced in 1990 as a direct result of the efforts that were being made through the 1986 law. And when that really failed, you just saw all of the flow just shift 14 miles inland, and the same number of people were crossing. And so in 1996, they passed another law that required the fence to be doubled, a second layer be added in San Diego, and more fencing in other urban areas. And really the goal there was not even to prevent illegal immigration per se, but just to force it into more rural areas where it was less noticeable. And maybe by forcing it into those rural areas, you would have fewer people want to cross the border because of essentially fear of death, of starvation or deprivation in the desert.
So part of the technological advance is forcing people to go through the desert if they want to get to the United States?
Exactly. Yeah. So the goal was quite explicitly, we're going to force them to risk their lives in order to get to the United States, and then fewer people will want to make that attempt. That did happen. Fewer people did make the attempt, but in the process, many hundreds and even thousands of people over the last couple of decades have died in the Arizona and Texas, New Mexico deserts.
Matthew Feeney, to you, the Customs and Border Patrol has expansive authority, a certain number of miles within the border. Where are our rights a little fuzzier along the border, and what is CBP empowered to do to even people who are U.S. citizens?
Yeah, so Customs and Border Protection reserve the right to conduct activities within actually 100 miles of the U.S. Land and maritime borders. This is an area that includes entire states such as Florida and a number of states in New England. And it's actually an area where about two-thirds of people in the United States live. So some listeners might be familiar with stories of internal checkpoints. So these are checkpoints that are actually away from the border where drivers can be stopped and ask the question, are you a U.S. citizen? My own opinion on this, and it's shared by other civil libertarians, is that this is an affront to the U.S. Constitution. Unfortunately, it has been upheld by Congress through statute, but also by the U.S. Supreme Court, which has held that internal checkpoints away from the border don't necessarily run afoul of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution.
So what there are no current challenges to this, or there are, but they don't tend to go anywhere?
There are challenges to this authority, but it's a bit of an uphill climb. There's a long precedent for something called the what's colloquially referred to as the border exception to the Fourth Amendment. So we see this not only when it comes to internal checkpoints, but also travelers who arrive at airports where CBP have the authority to search electronic devices, including phones and laptops, without first having to establish suspicion or probable cause.
All right. So I know Rand Paul has made a particular stink about this, going so far as to refuse some of these searches of his own devices. But where in legislation do we see anything that might be moving on it?
So Senator Paul and his Democratic colleague, Senator Wyden, as well as a few members of the House, have introduced legislation that would require DHS, so Department of Homeland Security, agents to first secure a warrant before searching these electronic devices. But at the moment, they haven't been implemented into law. I should mention, though, that we don't necessarily need Congress to pass legislation here. The executive branch could promulgate through policy this requirement, but the Trump administration has not been forthcoming in that respect.
So for CBP, and as you said, two-thirds of Americans live in this zone. What actually limits their authority, and how have they interpreted this authority so broadly?
So they are still limited by the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. So they, for example, CBP cannot, without reasonable suspicion, just pull someone over on the side of a road just because they decide to because they have a hunch that someone might be an illegal immigrant. That's why they set up these checkpoints. But they really do enjoy and have certainly interpreted the law to mean that they have many, many more avenues of investigation that traditional law enforcement just do not enjoy further into the interior.
So there are some other pieces of technology that have been adopted or may soon be adopted based on some current policy changes at the border. What are those?
So since the mid-2000s, CBP have been flying Predator drones, which many listeners will usually associate with our government's activities abroad. These are devices and tools that are used for targeted strikes in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. They're also used for surveillance there. And this surveillance capability is what CBP are very interested in. And it's something that the current administration and his allies on Capitol Hill have also expressed a desire to expand. But what's interesting about this is that actually these drones are not particularly effective at either seizing illegal drugs or apprehending people trying to cross the border illegally. On top of that, they're quite expensive. We're talking about, I think, about $12,000 per flight hour. But they, despite the fact that they are not particularly effective, there have been pushes to expand this capability. And this is worrying because these are highly intrusive surveillance tools that can infringe on the civil liberties of Americans. In addition to CBP using these, local law enforcement can request these assets be used for their own investigations. And it's of course not just these kind of big predator drones that are of concern. DHS is also interested in smaller drones that they would like to see outfitted with facial recognition technology. And given the border zone that we've just discussed, it's not exactly the case that if CBP had facial recognition drones that only illegal immigrants would have to be worried.
David, to you, what do you expect to see in the negotiations currently moving through with regard specifically to activities at the border and what the president wants and what he's likely to get?
So the president's asking for $24 billion in border security funding to fund a variety of activities, including his border wall construction, as well as more detention beds and space for detaining people who are caught near the border. One of the aspects of this is when you're talking about this amount of money, so $24 billion, to put in context, right now Border Patrol spends only a little bit more than $3 billion per year. And so they're talking about what would amount to more than six times as much funding for Border Patrol as what it currently spends in a given year. And so you're really talking about a situation in which we really need to talk about who benefits from all this spending. It is quite ineffective. The border fences have not been shown to reduce illegal immigration. The border drones have not been shown to reduce illegal immigration, but there is a huge industry in the United States that will stand to benefit from the government contracts that are being dispensed in order to, fund this huge expansion in border security. So General Atomics is the one, is the company that builds the Predator drone. They're looking for contracts with Border Patrol or Customs and Border Protection. You're talking about several contractors who currently, the contractors who are vying for the border wall are all companies that have annual revenue of less than or about $1 billion or less. And so you're talking about something that will cost, $24 billion to build out over the 1,000-plus miles of border. And so there's a lot of money here being spent, and a lot of companies stand to benefit. And I think that's really an aspect of this that needs some more attention.
What is the role of states here? I mean, there are a number of states that are on the border. There's private property at the border. There are Indian tribes that have some degree of sovereignty over the territory that they own that is on the border. What about those people?
Well, that's an important aspect of this as well. So two-thirds of the border is not owned directly by the federal government. And so the literal land along the border is in private hands, primarily in Texas. So if you look at where the Bush administration built the existing fences along the border, almost all of it is in public lands in Arizona, New Mexico, and California. There's the Rio Grande, of course, covering 1,200 miles in Texas. So there's less of a need for a fence there, although the Trump administration has been talking about building its wall in Texas. And if they do, then you're talking about taking private property from private property owners through eminent domain. And really what that process looks like from the private property owner's perspective is that you get a letter in the mail that says that the government is looking to seize your property. You have a couple of weeks in which you can challenge their condemnation proceedings in court legally. But as long as it's, condemnation for a public use, which it would be, then it's constitutional and it's legal. And immediately the government would seize control of your land. And only after that do you negotiate over what's called just compensation under the Constitution. We're entitled to really the market value of the land. And that's really up for debate. How much is this worth to you? How much is it worth on the market? How much would it depreciate the rest of the value of your land? And so that negotiations can take years. Some are even taking more than a decade from under the Bush administration. And so it's really a taking of your private property immediately and then years or even decades later talking about getting the compensation for that land. So one aspect of this that's really important is just the piece of surveillance that is being discussed by what I would call the moderate Republicans in Congress. So you have President Trump advocating for a physical wall along 1,200 to 1,500 miles of the 2,000-mile southwest border. And at the same time, you have the moderate Republicans talking about what's called a virtual fence. That's really code for surveillance along the entire border, 24/7, total and complete visual surveillance. And then that would allow Border Patrol to quickly respond to areas in which there are people crossing the border and deploy resources and make apprehensions that way, as opposed to building, a stationary physical wall that could be climbed over or dug under. And this has been around again for well over a decade. Boeing, again, another company who's really invested in this, received a $1 billion contract from the Bush administration to build a so-called virtual fence, and it completely failed. DHS abandoned the project in 2011. And really, we're back to square one. We're repeating history by talking about these ideas that have failed and will continue to fail into the future.
I've spoken about this with Jim Harper, and I've got a podcast coming out with him about this as well. It wasn't that long ago that your mainstream Republicans were virulently opposed to a national ID card. And now we're entering a moment where there needs to be essentially no card and that you have to present to anyone, because by virtue of the fact that you're presenting your face in public, that can be your card.
Yeah, I wrote recently about how our faces are increasingly becoming our papers. And that's thanks to this kind of facial recognition and biometric technology that we're becoming, sadly, increasingly used to. The fact is that the kind of immigration policies that have been announced and supported by the current administration will require that the government gather more and more information about not only immigrants but also citizens. Sadly, we're seeing this at a few airports across the country where DHS is trialing the use of facial scanners as part of the boarding process at international airports. And this is a huge worry for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's important to note that although Congress has authorized biometric collection, it never explicitly mandated or ordered or allowed the biometric collection of American citizens' faces, and yet there are reports that Americans have been subject to this. Another worry, of course, is that actually this technology is not as accurate as some science fiction films might make you think. There are a number of concerns associated with the fact that facial recognition, because it's not as accurate as people think, could lead to many Americans and other travelers being hassled or harassed when they shouldn't, thanks to the fact that this technology is far from perfect.
David Beer and Matthew Feeney are policy analysts at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.